I want to talk to you this morning about a little bit of a unique kind of lesson that we're going to present in attempting to overcome this Darwinian hypothesis. Now, as we approach this lesson this morning, there are a couple of caveats maybe that I'd like to offer. The goal for me in presenting this lesson is not that I'm going to present something new that you have not heard before or seen before, but I'm trying for my own benefit. I'm not a scientist, and I don't engage in scientific arguments, really, with people over the origin of life and such things. But what I try to do is use the God-given skills that I have to make appropriate judgments in matters. There are many things that I have to decide about in my life, that I have to make a decision about that I'm not particularly an expert in. You know, I have to buy a car, I have to buy a house, I have to do these other things. And there are many people who know more about those things than I do. And sometimes I'm able to consult with such people and use the information they give me to make those decisions. What I'm leading up to saying is that you're going to see some quotes in this lesson today from some impressive people that are quotes obviously oriented toward the design hypothesis rather than the Darwinian, you see. But I would like for each of us to come away from a lesson like this or any study that we do along these lines with the approach that we're going to wield a weapon that we can handle. That I'm not going to engage some fellow with six PhDs behind his name and all kinds of scientific history and in his study and education, I'm not going to engage him in some scientific discussion. But the things I know about science will lead me to a judgment, to a decision. And that's what I want us to be able to do, is to boil this subject down to how do we, the common man, use our common sense to arrive at the proper conclusion. Now, as you see on the board, a famous man, Wernher von Braun, says, "The vast mysteries of the universe should only confirm our belief in the certainty of its creator." And he makes a nice comparison here when he says, "I find it as difficult to understand a scientist who does not acknowledge the presence of a superior rationality behind the existence of the universe as it is to comprehend a theologian who would deny the advances of science." And he's trying to make the point that the two are not opposed to one another. God is not opposed to science. He created it. So science should, and we'll see, I think, as we go through the lesson, does lend to the design hypothesis. Faith does not imply a closed but an open mind, quite the opposite of blindness. Faith appreciates the vast spiritual realities that materialists overlook by getting trapped in purely physical. And so these men are famous men who have accomplished a lot in their lives, both in the science field and in their personal lives. And as a result, sometimes the weight of their opinion shapes the opinion of others. But what I want it to do for you and to me is to make us understand that very, very bright intellectual people have come to the same conclusion that you have. And I'm not suggesting you're not bright intellectual people either. But I'm trying to suggest that each of us sometimes looks to a big brother to support our point of view. And there are plenty of them on both sides of this issue. That's the reason I try to caution people not to get into a debate where you're just hurling quotation after quotation from each side, lobbing at the other, because there are many scientists who would argue with what these men have said. But I want us to notice just a few passages this morning that talk about what God says, at least, about the creation. And God saw everything that he'd made. This is obviously after the 6 days of creation, when he's created everything that's in the earth. And God saw everything that he'd made, and behold, it was very good, and there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Now, Psalm 19:1 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork." The purpose of the psalmist is to say, is to appeal to common sense, actually, and say, look around you and see the majesty of the creation around you and know that God played a part in that. And then Genesis 1:6-8 says, "And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. Let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament divide the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above. And it was so, and God called the firmament heaven, and there was evening and there was morning, a second day." And then finally in Ecclesiastes, the 3rd chapter, verse 11, "He, speaking of God, hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he hath set eternity in their heart, yet so that man cannot find out the work that God hath done from the beginning even to the end." I really like to focus on the phrase in there when he says, "He hath set eternity in their heart." There's something special about the creation of man that we'll notice as we go along that is just above and beyond what people seem to recognize and understand. You know, probably no one ever was more confident of his judgment, of his decision, of his belief in the outcome of something than the prosecutor several years ago in a case that was tried regarding a Ford Pinto that exploded and burned up 3 young ladies. It was struck on an open highway by a van in the rear, and the gas tank exploded and the ladies were killed, were burned to death, essentially. Although one of them did live a brief time before she died. And so the complaint of the defense was that this was not an extraordinary case where the Pinto was that much deficient, because the defense claimed that the Pinto was stopped in the middle of the highway and the van who hit it was moving at 50 miles an hour when it struck it, and it claimed that any car in those situations would more likely than not have an explosion of the gas tank and the same result. But the prosecutor was claiming, because of his interview of the driver of the van, he was claiming that the van, that the Pinto was not stopped and it was moving 15 to 20 miles an hour, which would have made the collision less violent. And therefore, he said the reason it exploded was because the Pinto was deficient, was faulty. Now, what happened in this case was that the prosecutor became so confident that he had the case won that he looked at the defense attorney and he says, "I want you to stop that Pinto. I want to see you stop that Pinto." He thought he had proven conclusively, because of the drivers of the van, because of his testimony, that the Pinto was moving. But what had happened was the driver of the van was never prosecuted. And the reason he wasn't was because he didn't have any money. And Ford Motor did. And therefore they were prosecuting Ford Motor with the idea of getting a large settlement, you see. Well, naturally the driver of the van was willing to go along with suggestive ideas from the prosecution. Unknown to the prosecution, the defense had investigated this case a little more thoroughly. They had found that when he was treated for minor injuries, the driver of the van had admitted to the doctor that he was treated by that the Pinto was stopped in the highway. Furthermore, 2 nurses who attended the one girl who lived after the accident for a brief period of time said the girl testifier told them that they had stopped the Pinto in the highway. He thus had stopped the Pinto and won the case as a result. Now, the point of telling that story is simply this, that if you want to know the truth about something, you've got to search for it. You're going to have to dig for it. You're going to have to try to find the answers. And they're not always easy. And when things become difficult and get confusing, you're going to have to search some more. But when you have an understanding, at least, of what you're searching for and the information you need to bring into it, it's perfectly possible to accomplish that. Now, in your case this morning, there's a reason that you have searched for, and at least the majority of you that I know personally, have found the truth. It may be that your parents influenced you from a child, that they taught you the scriptures, and that they had a great influence over your search for the truth. It might be a husband or a wife. In the case of a man named Lee Strobel, that, in fact, I think Aaron quoted Lee Strobel the other night in his lesson, but this man's a very educated man who decided, because his wife became a Christian, that he was going to show her how wrong she was. He was an atheist, admitted he was, and his wife became a Christian. He loved her dearly. It was never his concern or thought that he would ever, ever leave this relationship, this marital bliss they enjoyed, but he was going to prove that she was wrong, and he studied and he studied and he studied, and as a result, he's written three books, one called The Case for a Creator, one called The Case for Christ, and another called The Case for Faith. And he believes in God today. Because he searched with the goal of proving she was wrong and found out she was right. And it's interesting that when you decide to find the truth, even if you're opposed to it, even if it doesn't appeal to you, you can learn what the truth is, try hard enough. So I think what we need to understand is that it takes a very high degree of morality to find the truth of anything. Because the first thing we have to be willing to do is to overcome our own objections and to put our personal agenda aside and listen to the facts of the matter. In Matthew, the 13th chapter, verse 13 through 15, this was not the case. And Jesus calls that to our attention as a prominent case of people who were unwilling to investigate and find the truth. When he says, therefore, speak I to them in parables. He's answering a question from his disciples. He said, why do you speak in parables? Why don't you just spit it out, we might say. Why don't you just say it exactly like it is? He says, therefore, speak I to them in parables, because seeing they see not, and hearing they hear not, neither do they understand. And unto them is fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah, which saith, by hearing ye shall hear, and shall in no wise understand, and seeing ye shall see, and ye shall in no wise perceive. For this people's heart is wax gross. Their ears are dull of hearing. Their eyes they have closed, lest haply they should perceive with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and should turn again, and I should heal them. It is obvious that even among God's own people, he places challenges before us because he wants us to seek after him. As Paul told the Athenians, he is not far from each one of us. He wants us to seek after him, and therefore he doesn't want what do we call them, fair weather fans that we call sometimes at the ballpark or something, the people that only go when we're winning. And God and Christ want us to follow them, to be, as you will, committed and not just in a fair weather kind of an approach. So when one considers the scientific facts of the universe, he's going to come to one of two conclusions. With his moral integrity intact, he's going to have to decide between two things I'm going to offer today, and that is the design hypothesis and the Darwinian hypothesis. And he has to decide which the facts support. What everything he can call to his assistance tells him is the truth. Jonathan Wells said, like all scientific theories, Darwinian evolution must be continually compared with the evidence. If it does not fit the evidence, it must be reevaluated or abandoned. Otherwise, it's no longer science, but it is just a myth. And I submit to you today that the Darwinian hypothesis has been challenged so thoroughly and so often and so successfully that it is just that today. It is a myth. It is something that is sustained and carried on in the hearts and the minds of those who simply do not want to accept the ideas of God. And so, here are some things by which we can judge it. He says, Wells says we have to continually evaluate it. Here are some things by which we can evaluate it. It demands, first of all, that nothing produces everything. Everything that's in existence today came from nothing. It also says that non-life produces life. That's the most basic argument against the Darwinian hypothesis that exists, and that is, show me in a laboratory, show me anywhere you choose that non-life can produce life. And that has never been accomplished. It shows us, or it demands rather, that randomness produces order and fine-tuning, that chaos produces information. Unconsciousness produces consciousness. That's an interesting point we'll make at the close of the lesson, that non-reason produces reason. Klaus Dose said, at present, all discussions on principle theories and experiments in the field either end in stalemate or in a confession of ignorance when we talk about proving conclusively what the origin of life is. And of course, he's looking at it from being able to prove it in a laboratory. And so, let's take six areas in which we look from the design hypothesis approach and examine the failures, if you will, of the Darwinian approach. First of all, the field of cosmology, general philosophy of the universe considered as a totality of parts and phenomena subject to laws. In other words, the cosmic universe in which we live has various things that are constant, that have been constant since its beginning. And based on that, whatever begins to exist has a cause, is an agreed upon point by both sides of the argument. Nobody on either side with any reputation takes a position that something that began existed without a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe has a cause. Now there's something that brought it about. That's what we're trying to approach here. How do we find out just what it is? The demand then is, show me, if I'm challenging the naturalist, you show me the naturalistic cause of the existence of the universe. That basically is the same argument or same challenge that you issue when you say, show me how you can produce life from non-life. Show me how anything can come to life that is not alive. Science writer Robert Roy Britt describes a problem this way. And he says this is the problem that the Darwinian has, or the naturalist has, when he tries to prove what caused the universe. He says, have you ever had one of those dreams where you try to run from a monster and your legs go round and round, but you don't get anywhere? He said, the quest to understand the origin of life isn't really much different. It's about the same. So, the problem that is faced by the Darwinian is this. The fossil record just really does not support what Darwin himself initially claimed to be the case. And Darwin in defense of Darwin himself, pointed out some areas in which his theory was subject to examination and could be proven wrong if such and such happened. Well, one of the problems they have in the fossil record is that there are these gaps in that don't connect. The dots do not connect. And so, as they are prone to do, they came up with an explanation for that. It's called the Cambrian explosion. Well, what can I tell you about the Cambrian explosion except they're saying that all of a sudden the pattern changed. They want to follow a pattern up to this point, and then they can't connect it with this point, and so they say in between here there was a big change. Just happened overnight, so to speak, instead of in billions of years, millions of years, which is overnight to them. Well, that's a difficulty for them. And so they come up with this idea called the Cambrian explosion. Well, that doesn't totally satisfy, so then comes along a fella, and he says, I think it's Gould that says, is credited with the phrase punctuated equilibrium, which he's using to express the same, give the same explanation of that gap in the fossil record, you see. But the point is that their hypothesis falls at that stage, and they've got to create another story to fill that gap. Now, the problem we face in our debate over this in our society is that there are people who do not approach this with moral integrity. Now, there are people who do on both sides of the issue, and I want to make that clear. But there are people who do not, and when they do not, and when they propagate something that is not founded in actual science, many of their colleagues leap on board because it solves temporarily the problem that they're facing, you see, such as the Cambrian explosion and the punctuated equilibrium. The problem that dogs this theory is that Darwin admitted there would need to be further discoveries in the fossil record to substantiate his theory. We don't have them all. Darwin lived in the 19th century. We don't have them all. And so there's going to be more fossil records uncovered as archaeology continues to work, and we're going to learn more and more, and it has to substantiate the theory. But the problem's been the more archaeological discoveries we've made has actually denigrated and gone against his point of view. And so he has not actually been able to accomplish maybe what he would have wanted to accomplish. Well, let's move on. Another area is physics, the science that treats of the laws governing motion, matter, and energy under conditions susceptible to precise observation, generally considered in distinction from chemistry and the sciences dealing with living matter. Physics is dealing with how the thing works together, how it's put together, very related to the cosmology and the astronomy fields, very closely related in the things that it points out to us and that it teaches us about the universe. But one of the most impressive aspects of the contribution physics makes to our debate is the precision of all the factors such as gravity, distance of the planets and stars from each other, calibrated so perfectly to allow the universe to sustain life. Now, when you talk about sustaining life, the physics that are involved in allowing us to breathe the kind of air we need to breathe, to have the proper light that we need to live, to have the proper relief from light and heat that we need to let all those things that come into play. There's something called the anthropic principle. And a fellow named Patrick Glenn, who once was an atheist, abandoned his atheism based on arguments concerning this principle. He says, today the concrete data points strongly in the direction of the God hypothesis. It is the simplest and most obvious solution to the anthropic puzzle. What we're at odds here is, does it require some powerful being with a mind, with an intelligence, to bring about what we see? To bring about this collection of people here and all over the world who have the faculties that you have. What does it take? That's the anthropic puzzle that he's talking about. How could something have accidentally happened is the real question that you've asked many times. How could something have accidentally happened that creates an atmosphere? I don't literally mean the physical atmosphere so much as I mean just a general atmosphere in which something such as all of what we see, the fauna, the flora, mankind that we see living and thriving in this atmosphere. That's the anthropic principle. And that, of course, is the question of naturalism. How does it produce this perfect atmosphere for human life? It's just a major step and a major challenge. Now, astronomy is very similar. The science that treats of the heavenly bodies, their motions, magnitude, distances, and physical constitution. It would take a star with the highly unusual properties of our sun, the right mass, the right light, the right age, the right distance, the right orbit, the right galaxy, the right location to nurture living organisms on a circling planet. Now, whether you believe God caused that, or whether you believe that happened naturally, you must admit this actually pinpoints what we've been talking about with physics and even cosmology. This talks about how precise it had to be. Now people that know more about this than I do can tell you what would happen if our sun were reduced by this much, if our sun were increased by this much. In fact, probably the best judge of that would be to analyze planets such as Mercury, Venus, and Mars, where it is either increased or decreased by that much, you see. But that's that's just a logical thought that you would have, but it is clear that since it operates so precisely as it does, that it has to operate that way in order for us to be able to exist and to maintain our life on the earth. John O'Keefe, who's an astrophysicist from Harvard, says, it's my view that these circumstances indicate the universe was created for man to live in. That's kind of his, now he throws the word created in there, which gives you some idea of what he's thinking is, I understand. But the impetus of his statement is that this universe was put here for man to live in. It's too perfect. It sustains exactly what's here. It had to be put here for that. Instead of looking at it the other way around, this is what came about as a result of what the universe became, you see. So, again, the question, please explain how the universe, planets in relation to one another, came about naturally. How do you explain how that came about naturally? I'm going to mention something here that is really a difficult subject. And this is this kind of thing, unless you've studied it, is hard to be expert enough to grasp all that is said about it. So I want you to understand that the evidence I'm going to put on here has been refuted. Now, whether it's been successfully refuted or not is the question, but it's been argued against by plenty of scientists. So it's not just that everybody in the world believes what is about to be said here, but biochemistry is a branch of chemistry relating to the processes and physical properties of living organisms. Darwin said himself, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organism existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Now, there's a man named Michael Behe who wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. And In it, he discusses this point about irreducible complexity or irreducibly complex. And what he really means is that there are some organisms that function only as they are and could not have functioned and provided the function they now provide rather, prior to the way they're made up. His example is such things as cilia or flagella or flagella, however you pronounce that, but they're tiny little cells that have little legs or arms on them that enable them to swim and to move around and so forth. And his argument is that they are irreducibly complex. They have to exist as they are right now. Therefore, they had to have existed this way from the beginning. They could not have evolved into this because they could not, the function they provide would not have been provided while they were evolving. You see? Now that's the gist of it. If you try to go any more scientifically into it than that, you're going to have to talk to somebody else. But the point is that B, he says, summed up in a single word, it calls for design because they have to be this way as they are now to have ever provided a function. I say that based on science. I believe that irreducibly complex systems are strong evidence of a purposeful, intentional design by an intelligent agent. He is a biochemist, and he does not entertain at all the idea that these things are not irreducibly complex. He's not entertaining that at all. The only thing he's entertaining on the part of people is you make your decision on whether you think it's by design or naturalism. And so the challenges of this are thrown strictly at the macroevolution concept versus the microevolution. Now, everybody believes in microevolution. We all accept that. We can look at pictures that have been taken in the history of mankind and drawn and so forth and see that things have changed. So we understand that. But what about the leap? What about the leap, as he's talking about, from something that is simple to something that is complex? And his argument is that that does not happen. And so, let's look at biology as we try to move on here. The science of life and all its manifestations, of the origin structure, reproduction, growth, and development of living organisms collectively as two main divisions are botany and zoology. So, here's where the argument about information begins to come into play. No one can or has explained how information got into the biological matter by naturalistic means. Of course, none of these things have been explained by naturalistic means, but this one stands out as probably the most recent that we have, these next two points are the most recent points we've really begun to discover and to discuss because of knowledge that we've come up with them. But there is 6 feet of DNA coiled inside our bodies, 100 trillion cells. And this DNA contains a four-letter alphabet, which includes the precise assembly instructions for all the proteins of which our bodies are made. Now, when the DNA thing came out, this was just another brick, if you will, not a straw that broke the camel's back. This was a brick that was dropped on the camel's back of naturalism. Because if it were not precise enough for you, the discussion we've had about the universe itself, when you begin to talk in today's understanding of just what goes on in the human body, it is so complex. It is so unique to every individual. Every one of us, this is unique to every one of us. And you all are looking at me saying, boy, I'm glad too. But seriously, It is something that just is astounding when you think about it. But then anything, listen to these two points, anything that has a complex sequential arrangement and corresponds to an independent pattern or function is always the product of intelligence. It doesn't happen by accident. These things don't happen by accident. If it has complex sequential arrangement and that arrangement corresponds to an independent pattern or function, then intelligence was designed. You can go back to the watch and all the other examples been used over the years. Whatever you want to use for an example of that, you can use that. But that's something we recognize, and we recognize it more today in books, computers, and yes, even today now, DNA. So we recognize that very clearly, you know, and they laugh and scoff at the idea that someone threw all these pieces of a watch out there and they just gravitated together, you know. They laugh at that idea, but that's exactly what you're talking about when you talk about a naturalistic explanation. Information is the hallmark of the mind, not the brain, the mind, okay? And purely from the evidence of genetics and biology, we can infer the existence of a mind that's far greater than our own, a conscious, purposeful, rational, intelligent designer who's amazingly creative, Stephen Meyer says. Our question of the naturalist here is, do you propose naturalism as a method of creating intelligence and placing such a system of intelligence in mankind as we know exists today? And the answer is obviously no. Intelligence comes from intelligence. It's just the way it works. Let's look at this last point. I want you to listen to this carefully because this is kind of cutting edge stuff here. But Professor J.P. Moreland defined consciousness as our introspection, sensations, thoughts, emotions, desires, beliefs, and free choices that make us alive and aware. The soul contains our consciousness and animates our body. It is the mind. Now, notice it's not the brain, it's the mind. Because research has shown consciousness continues past death. This makes it separate from the brain. People who've been brain dead have still had consciousness. And they've done that with research to prove that, see? Now, you can't get something from nothing. If the universe began with dead matter having no conscious, how do you get something totally different? Consciousness, living, thinking, feeling, believing creatures from materials that don't have that is his conclusion, of course. And so we need to recognize that what he's saying is that there is a soul of man. There is something beyond the brain of man, in other words. We generally, if we're not careful, we talk about the heart and the mind being the brain. We think of it being the brain. Well, it's not really. It's the heart of it. It's the center of it. It's the soul of it. Genesis 2:7, God breathed into man and he became a living soul. Okay? So we need to recognize that. This repeats Behe's challenge to the entire concept of macroevolution, much like the challenge facing Cambrian explosion and punctuated equilibrium. Okay, I want to conclude this very quickly here, but I don't want us to miss out on what we're really concluding from what we've talked about. We're at the point of decision. Can you decide? Be objective and use common sense. Intelligence is the answer, not some unexplainable activity that suddenly brings to life that which is dead. That's my common sense reasoning. That's what I'm saying to you. I'm saying to you, unless you show me some evidence that it happens, life doesn't come from something that's dead. It comes from life. And life has to then originate at some point, being created. I want you to consider some historically subjective conclusions, but before we do that, I want to try to sum up what we've talked about. Let me try to run through these. About 5 points I want to make very quick. The universe began to exist. It therefore has a cause. Where is the naturalistic cause of its existence? That'd be number one. The exactness of the physics of our universe makes it habitable for man. Naturalistic explanation? I doubt there's one there. The precision of the planets, the sun, moon, etc., of our universe. Again, make it support human life. How did it happen? How do we get this anthropic principle, this perfect atmosphere for human life? We must accept irreducible complexity if we cannot disprove it. In other words, if you can't show me how cilia and flagella and all the other things that fall in that category operated when they were not complex, if you can't show me how they functioned when they were reduced from their complexity to simplicity, then you can't disprove it. Can naturalism produce life from non-life? If so, why has it not been done? Naturalism has the burden of explaining the consciousness of the human during and after death. That's a difficult one there. It's a difficult one. It's one they're just really beginning to become aware of and study, but nevertheless, it is a problem that exists. Now, we'll talk about the Jews rejecting Christ. This is kind of a capsule, if you will, of the concept of someone believing what he wants to believe. Now, we do that in some things. I believe red meat's healthy. I believe a lot of red meat's healthy because I like a lot of red meat. But that doesn't mean I'm anyways near right. There are a lot of people that would that know much more about that than I do that would discourage me from eating that much red meat, you see. And so we do believe things that we want to believe. Or we just ignore the facts and do them anyway, whichever way you want to describe it. We do not always objectively analyze and conclude. Now my suggestion to you is that Jews in John 12, 40 through 43 is an incident where it talks about the fact that the leaders in the synagogues and those even on the Sanhedrin, those men believed in Jesus intellectually. They believed he was the Christ. But they refused to accept him, and basically it was for two reasons as we study the scope of Scripture. Number one was, he wasn't providing for them what they wanted. And number two, if they believed in him, they were going to have to renounce Judaism, essentially, and they were going to lose their positions of power economically, socially, and so forth. They had a reason for concluding an error and applying it to their lives. In John 7, 45 and 46, when they sent gendarmes or whatever they are to arrest Jesus, they didn't bring him back, and they were asked the questions why they didn't, and they said, as they observed him speaking, their answer was, never man so spake. And in Matthew 7, 28, it talks about after, that's the very last verse in Matthew's account of the Sermon on the Mount, and the multitudes were astonished with the lessons Jesus taught in Matthew 5, 6, and 7 there. They were astonished. They were amazed. They believed what he had to say. Now, many of them in that multitude right there were not among those 3,000 on the day of Pentecost that obeyed the gospel. Many of them. So people didn't all, because of what their intellect told them, they didn't necessarily act on that. That's my point. And I want you to ask yourself the question of both yourself and the opponents, if you will, of the gospel and God and Christ and what they've set forth for us in the revelation of His Word. I want you to ask yourself the question as to whether you think a person's decision, whatever person makes a decision, is it based on subjective reasoning that causes his decision to accommodate his chosen life? Or is he making a decision based objectively regardless of how it affects his life? Because that's where we need to be. And it doesn't matter what you're deciding on. Now, there are a lot of things. If I buy a Chevy instead of a Ford, it may be a big mistake, but it's not nearly as big a mistake as if I reject God instead of accepting Him. it doesn't have near the consequences at the end, you see. And so there are decisions that we make in life that we may make at our own pleasure. The steak and baked potato, for instance. We may choose that for our pleasure and to accommodate maybe our nutrition, some level of nutrition in the process. But there are some things that are so important, you can't do that. When you go to the doctor and he says, "Mister, your cholesterol is out of sight." It is out of sight. And if you continue eating the way you're eating, you're going to be dead in 2 years. Most of us then say, "Well, okay, let's eat some fish and chicken or whatever, vegetables, whatever. Let's change things around." Because that's important enough. You see, that's crucial enough. And that's what we've got to decide. This is a very, very important decision that we're going to make, whoever we are. And the people who are making what we think is the wrong decision are still people that we're supposed to love and care for and want to go to heaven when they die. So we need to continue to try to teach. We need to continue to try to encourage. But I'm trying to suggest to you and to me that we need to avoid getting in over our head in some discussion that will lead to nowhere and try to reason with the decision-making ability of people. Try to get them down to their decision-making ability. And what is your decision based on? Because most of the people who know a little bit more about science than you do and quote you some science that you don't know about, don't know enough about to be quoting what they're quoting. You know, we get in here and we start lobbing grenades back and forth across the fence, and probably both of us are half inaccurate when we start talking about science. But my eyes and my mind and my body and my heart and soul has some experience to come into play in this decision. And therefore, I can, through observation, I can still retain my common sense. I hope that we all do. And moral integrity, common sense, will lead one to the right decision. And that's really the conclusion, if you will. Maybe those here this morning who need to obey the gospel. I do not know, but I would encourage you to do this. That if you do believe that God created the heavens and the earth, then you have already admitted that you are subject to His will by believing that He has that power to create you. And therefore, being subject to His will, you must obey His will in order to receive the promises that He made to those He created, and that is eternity in heaven with Him. We'd want you to have that, and we'd want you to make the decision that it takes to achieve that as we stand and sing the song that's been selected.